It's time to meet up and catch up at the Weekend Water Cooler. Now, here's your host, Gene Bolduc.
Welcome to the Weekend Water Cooler, a very special holiday edition in which I am joined by a gentleman who I have known for some years. I don't want to say how many, Walter Jackson. Hello, Walter.
Hi, Gene.
Otto White Jr. Hello, Otto.
Hello, Gene.
And Lewis Burton. Lewis.
Hello, Gene.
Oh, I love them. I'm telling you, that voice is just music to me. I think you have a big career ahead of you in radio. I'm not kidding. I'm going to make him say it again. I want you to say this again. Today, we're recording today, December 20th, when the new and the last Star Wars movie is debuting. And I just want you to say it again. Luke. I am your father.
I am your father.
I'm telling you, this is big. This is big. We finally know who's behind that. I think we really have the better part of Darth Vader, really. Anakin Skywalker. I'm just going to call you Anakin Skywalker from now on because of that voice. That's big. And if you can sing, I don't even want to talk about it. Can he sing?
Otto is the one who sings.
Well, this is the story of my life. All right. Well, we're here today because you all are who we call Black Pioneers, we of Carolina. And you were among and included in the first classes of African Americans to graduate from UNC, thanks in part to the work of our good friend Floyd McKissick Sr. and his work, which is documented in The Story of Walter Jackson's Life, a book I wrote, African Americans of Durham and Orange Counties. I might as well put in a plug for the book.
No doubt.
Not about me, but so you can read about Walter because he's an absolutely fascinating individual. Your experience coming into the university was singular. I mean, it was really, I'm sure, difficult, fascinating, and I'm not going to be the one talking about most of it. So I'm going to ask one of you to raise his hand. Good for you, Lewis. And tell me about the day that you arrived at Carolina.
Well, the day that I arrived at Carolina, I was brought to Carolina, my father and I. Mm-hmm. You know, we came to Carolina, and we were to assemble in Girard Auditorium, and that was going to be the staging place for me to go to the camp that was sponsored by the YMCA. Mm-hmm. And that was the first experience that I had. I think this was in September of 1961.
Wow.
So you beat me to freshman camp by 2 years at Carolina.
Yes.
Well, that explains a lot. Or does it? Or does it? So every good thing that happened to you when you got there is because, you know, Lewis plowed the road.
Lewis, in fact, was a pioneer to me as a pioneer, but Lewis and Otto were classmates, so they both got there in the fall of 1961.
Wow,
yes.
Wow.
And in fact, Lewis and I and a guy named John Kirk from Goldsboro, we were freshmen at the same in 61, mm-hmm. and right. we were also roommates at Cobb Dormitory.
307.
Yeah.
307 Cobb, yes.
And it was not coincidence that they were roommates. The university, in its great wisdom of the day, put all of the African-American students together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which, you know, could sound like, did you feel like that was a negative thing or a positive thing?
Well, in my opinion, it was a positive thing because I applied late to the university mm-hmm. and I was informed that there would be no student housing available.
Oh.
So.
That didn't turn out to be true.
Well, what happened was my mother, corresponded with my academic dean mm-hmm. and asked if there was any way that I could have some student housing. Mm-hmm. And she received a reply. You know, by mail. It was in mail those days.
Yeah.
That yes.
She didn't get an email or a tweet or anything. Yeah, right.
By mail, that accommodations could be made for me to have student housing.
Huh.
And then when I came after the Y, and they gave me my dormitory assignment.
Wow.
307 Cobb. So when I went to 307 Cobb, I met my roommates. My roommates were Otto White.
Right.
And John Kirk.
And that felt pretty good, I bet. Really. I mean,
key was I was going to be on campus.
Right.
Right. I was across the, out my window, I could see the tennis court.
That's okay. Pretty sweet. I know that location. That's pretty sweet right over there.
And then I could walk to class.
Right.
Right. And my mother wanted me to be on campus.
Right.
That was significant for her.
Now, was it, do you think that it was, that her, or do you know, was her concern for your safety? Or just that she wanted you to be, you know, in student life and experiencing the campus?
No, what it was she wanted me to be in an environment that I would not have distractions.
Right. I think I'm picking up what you're putting down there.
Yeah.
She wanted you to be an excellent student, represent yourself well, stay on track.
And she didn't want me to be distracted.
Right.
Now, and I can give you some background on why she did not want me to be distracted.
Oh, yes, please.
All right. Because I'm from Fayetteville, North Carolina.
Okay.
Which is a military town.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And I was leaving home for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was important.
Right.
To her.
Right.
That I be in an environment where I was not distracted.
Right, 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 right. Not just military, but Army.
Yes.
Always Army, right?
Yes.
That was always an Army base there. Yeah, and yeah, I think I got you there. Well, Otto, tell me about when you arrived at Carolina. How was it for you?
Well, my very first thoughts were the fact that I had two excellent roommates, very smart fellas.
Right.
One was a valedictorian of his class.
Oh, wow.
John Kirk from Goldsboro, and the other one was a high-ranking member of his class. I'm not sure he was valedictorian, but
he's too humble to say.
But one of the gems of Fayetteville,
mm-hmm.
and from an athletic standpoint, Fayetteville and New Bern, where I'm from,
J.T.
Barber High School in New Bern was a segregated high school, and so was
E.
Smith and Fayetteville, and we were athletic and, I guess,
rivals.
Rivals, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Excuse me, I know it's not my turn yet, but I've just got to interrupt
and
put in a plug for Hillside as they're talking about their high schools in New Bern and Fayetteville. That's... Hillside and Durham was also on that level and competed on the gridiron and court and other places with those two schools.
So true, so true.
Exactly right. Please continue after that interruption.
Right, I'm sorry. John Kirk was a very short built fellow.
Mm-hmm.
And Lewis is a little heavier than I am.
Okay.
But I came to Carolina weighing
about
100 pounds.
Is that right? Wow.
That's right. Yeah. And when I left, I was like 210.
Oh, cut it out.
Okay. 6 years later, I did some graduate work here.
Yeah.
And when I left in 6 years, I was about 210.
That's always an interesting time in life for young men. Sometimes they blossom into these blockbuster bodies, right? You know, you arrive, you're 17 or 18, and your parents are thinking, well, he's pretty well grown now. Oh, no.
Still had some growing to do. Right,
right. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, I was, impressed with the fact that I had two black classmates.
Yeah.
And they were in different majors. John was in history, and Lewis was in business. And I was a chemistry major.
Okay. This sounds like a great company starting right here already.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we never had any classes together. In fact, there were no black instructors. There were no black counselors, no black advisors. I'm stretched to recall ever taking a class with another black person.
So, you know, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but did you feel like when you came back to the dorm at the end of the day that it was like coming home to your family after being in kind of a foreign environment? Did it feel you know, warm and reassuring in those ways. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, that it was quite belonging. Reassuring to come back to the dome. Yeah, to the dome because, you know, we were going to trade stories today. This is what happened to me. And
exactly,
this is what
right,
to you.
Right. And these are things that you couldn't tell other students and have them really understand in the way that your roommates could.
No, because our backgrounds were similar. So we had similar experiences
right.
and that we could relate.
Right.
To them. But the most important thing was that we could encourage each other.
Right, right, exactly. Yeah, and in a way that your family can and that your own community can just in general, you know, today even. That's kind of a universal. So I guess that was a smart thing that the university did to put you all together so you could support each other.
I don't think the university did it. To put us together to support each other.
No, I think they, no, don't get me wrong. I don't think that was their,
right.
You know, high-minded objective. It just turned out to probably
exactly.
be a good thing is what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely.
But I appreciate you stopping me at that point because I don't want to let that hang out there. No, in fact, maybe that's the thing that they did that backfired.
Well, they put us in a situation where we did not have support group from, as I said, faculty advisors
right.
and so forth.
Right.
So we had to serve as our own support
right.
group.
Right. They just gave you nothing right. structurally, right. so you had to create that yourself.
That's right.
Right. What else is new, right? Okay. I'm going to get to Walter, but I'm going to hang it out there for just a minute because we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back, and now we're really going to hear it from Walter Jackson. We're talking to the Black Pioneers from UNC, and don't go away. We'll be right back. We're back on the Weekend Water Cooler, and we're joined by the Black Pioneers of UNC. And I feel like, you know, you guys are my crew now. I feel like I'm in good company here. We're going to take a moment here, and we're going to get the history, the wide history, expansive history of Walter Jackson in just a moment. But I do want to go back and retrace one particular piece of perspective that Lewis has brought up, which is that you all arrived at UNC in 61. And what did you tell me about James Meredith arrived at Mississippi in...
In the fall of 62.
In 62. And so, you know, we look up in the history books and he would get, you know, and deserves, and I'm glad he has it, a lot of recognition for what he went through at
yes.
Mississippi. But there were African-American students at Carolina several years before Mississippi, and now Walter's going to rewind a little bit of those details that he just told me, just as a memory test, and then you're going to tell me about your arrival at Carolina from, say it with me again, Hillside High School in Durham, North Carolina.
Oh, you mean that little school in Durham that's the greatest high school in North Carolina?
I think it would be that one.
At least it was at that time.
It would be that one, yes.
Okay,
yes.
Very good.
And just, you know, take that, Chapel Hill High. I'm just, you know, we're a Chapel Hill station, so we're going to have to say that. But, okay, you are listening to 97.9 The Hill, but go ahead, Walter, and just describe for us leaving your nest in Durham, and I know that really was a nest for you, a very comfortable community that you grew up in, and especially the Hillside community, and then came to Carolina, and I'm just going to sit back and drink water for a few minutes while you tell us about that experience.
Thanks, Jean. It was sort of a culture shock for me to come from Hillside High School in 1963 to Carolina because growing up in Durham, I lived in an all-black world. I went to a black church, went to all-black schools with all-black teachers. Everyone in my neighborhood was black. I
yeah.
rarely went downtown. And then all of a sudden in 1963, I'm transported to this overwhelmingly
right.
white world at Chapel Hill. As I recall, there were about 10,000 students at Carolina at that
wow.
time. And I believe out of that 10,000 students, there might have been maybe 30 African-American undergraduates. Probably, actually not 30, because in my freshman class, there were only about 17, I believe.
Wow.
And that more than doubled the number who were already here.
Right.
The university had first integrated or desegregated, if you will, in 1952 when the first African Americans came into the UNC Law School. But it was not until 1955 when the first African American undergraduates were admitted, two of them, by the way, from Hillside.
And not to rub it in.
And it was 1961 before the first African American received an undergraduate degree at Carolina. So when I came in 1963, again, this was very shortly after integration. Now, surprisingly, I mentioned that two of the first three undergraduates were from Hillside. Even though I was just 8 years after them, I had no awareness of them when I came here
really?
In 1963.
Wow. That's interesting. Wow.
And I had no idea what I would encounter in terms of the numbers of other African American students, what the environment would be like, or any of that.
Right.
So I was very pleased when I arrived at the university and found other African American students, including upper class persons like Lewis and Otto, mm-hmm. to help provide a more welcoming environment for me and support to me as I began to navigate the path towards
right.
a degree at Carolina.
And you know, navigating your way to a degree at Carolina is a situation all of its own.
Absolutely.
It's not uncomplicated in the best of circumstances. So it's a big challenge. And to be, you know, I went to Carolina, I think, as you know, as an older student. I was in my 30s when I went to Carolina. And I went to Central first and became a, you know, junior eligible for transfer, then transferred. But I mean, I had children. I had two kids at home that were young, and I lived in Chapel Hill, so I wasn't living on campus. But I found that, you know, more than sufficiently challenging to get through, you know, everything that it takes to put together your degree and complete your education there. And I've often thought, I'm so glad I didn't arrive here when I was 18 years old. I would have been so overwhelmed and would not have known what to do, and I would have dropped out, walked away, and I never would have gone back.
Absolutely.
Because it's intimidating.
That.
Yeah.
I have often said it wasn't easy being black at Carolina in those days, and probably isn't these days.
Right.
But then I added, it's not supposed to be easy for any student at Carolina. Carolina is a challenging academic
right.
environment.
Right.
And again, to be African American in the 60s here made it all the more challenging.
Right. So I'm going to sort of kick this off into our next element here, which is to ask you just briefly about, and then we're going to talk about it in the next segment, about how it was with Silent Sam. Talk to me a little bit. I mean, I know this history, but I want to hear it from you, what you understood the history of Silent Sam to be when you arrived at Carolina. Was that, as we say in the vernacular today, was that a thing when you got there? Did you look at that and say, oh no, look at that statue? Or was that just another statue that was primarily there for white supremacy that you were like, you know, get in line?
It was more the latter.
Yeah.
In that great song, The Way We Were, I think there's a great line about have we forgotten the way it was, basically.
Right, right.
So in 1963, there were Confederate monuments all over
right.
the South.
Right, right.
Certainly on the Courthouse Square in Durham.
Right.
Here on the campus at Carolina. Everywhere you looked.
Right.
And that monument, whereas offensive, did not particularly stand out on the landscape to me, and I think to many other African American students, above many other affronts that
right.
were there for African American students. Back in those days, there were Confederate flags all over the campus
right.
at Carolina.
Right.
At halftime during the football and basketball games, they would play Dixie, and everybody was expected to stand up and
say, hooray, hooray, on those lines.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
So that Confederate monument was just a footnote almost in
right.
the array of affronts to African American students. So it was noted by all incoming freshmen as Silent Sam. That was the nickname for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there was a little legend that it was a soldier who fired his gun every time a virgin walked past.
Right, right.
And I don't know that it was even particularly noted for most people that it was a Confederate soldier.
Right, exactly.
So it was, by and large, not an issue
right.
at that time to the level that it became an issue later on.
Yeah, that particular legend is the thing that I remembered it more for. Over the last 30 years or so that I've been especially aware of that particular statue. And I always thought that was particularly misogynistic.
Mm-hmm.
But again, and very similarly, it was like in the context of so much other stuff that particular data point was not especially important to me. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to get into the actions that you all have taken recently about Silent Sam toward the Board of Governors and what you're hoping will come from that, which is, I hope the same thing. I'll put that out there and leave it dangling. Thank goodness, listeners, you're listening to 97.9 The Hill. We're going to go away for just a minute and we'll be right back. Don't go away. And we're back with the UNC Pioneers, the Black Pioneers. Now, you all have written a really important letter to the Board of Governors criticizing the university's, I don't know, is it a settlement or a proposed settlement to pay a Confederate advocacy group or whatever you want to call them to take custody of Silent Sam and pay them a bundle of money for it. Walter, I'm going to make you tell the story because you're the journalist in the group here. I want you to summarize for me as quickly as you can exactly what the university has either decided to do or proposed to do. I'm not sure which it is, actually, to be honest with you. So bring me up to date and then tell me what you all are doing.
Not sure we have enough time to talk about the whole background of that thing and how we got to where we are. But the first thing I
Try.
Do is challenge your question, was it a settlement or a proposed settlement? I would say it was neither, because settlement suggests that it's going to settle something. The
That's
action
a very
that
good
was
point.
Taken
right.
by the Board of Governors would not settle anything. As a matter of fact, it would pour kerosene on a fire, in my opinion,
to
come.
What was their thinking or their stated reason, more accurately, for taking this action, which is, and you're right, I use that word because it's been promoted that it is that, but of course it's not that, because the settlement suggests that there's been a lawsuit and there's been some hearing of facts and arguments and so forth, and none of that happened. There was no lawsuit, correct?
The report is that a lawsuit was filed on the morning of the purported settlement. So to the degree that settles a lawsuit, perhaps it was a settlement. But
only in the technical legal sense,
exactly.
perhaps.
This
perhaps.
Whole thing is totally inexplicable to most people outside
right.
the rooms where it happened.
Right.
And
what
again, the public understanding is that, of course, we need to go a little bit into the background of how we got here.
Yep.
There was this monument on campus known as Silent Sam,
right.
and I like to call it the monument known as Silent Sam rather than Silent Sam, because just calling it Silent Sam makes
right.
it seem much more innocuous than
right.
it really
so-called.
Was.
We'll call it
right.
so-called Silent Sam.
Okay. So the so-called Silent Sam monument was erected in the early 20th century, 1913, as I recall,
I think that's right. Mm-hmm.
As a symbol of the Confederacy, and really it was all about white supremacy.
Right.
And from 1913 until 2018, it stood there on the campus. And in the years leading up to 2018, it became very controversial, and a lot of people were arguing that it should be removed from the campus. There was another side, however, saying that no, it should remain. It's a symbol of our heritage and history and whatever. In 2018, some students topple the statue, and it was taken away for storage. There was a state law involving whether or not it had to be put back in place. Well, after it was in storage for a year or so, magically, one day, a proposed resolution came out from the Board of Governors in which they were going to pay $2.5 million to the Sons of Confederate Veterans to take this monument off the university's hands and for the future care and storage of the monument. For many people, including myself, that was just outrageous.
Right.
I'll try not to get into the Sons of Confederate Veterans and what they are all about and how that money might have been used. But again, this was a supposed resolution to the problem of the Confederate Memorial and what to do with it that, to a lot of people, just made the situation even worse than it already was.
Yeah, I that's just been whether my opinion agrees with yours, but it does, or not. It's just a simple observation of fact that it has settled exactly nothing. And it's like another data point on a long list of things that the Board of Governors does lately that is like, what are they doing? I mean, what is it that they think they're doing? Do they think, for example, that they are settling this, or do they think that they can satisfy a group by doing it this way? The money that they are proposing to use to do this settlement is not taxpayer money, correct?
That is correct.
Whose money is that?
My understanding is that money, that $2.5 million, was supposed to come from interest off the university's endowment, which comes from private contributions. So to that degree, it's not taxpayer money, but it is money that people have given to the university to support its academic programs and that sort of thing.
And so the people who donated that money into that fund were not donating for Silent Sam, so-called Silent Sam preservation.
Absolutely not.
And so, if one of those dollars was mine and I thought I was giving it to build a library or something, I think I would not be happy about that. So there's all of that. And so your group of individuals.
Well, there have been a lot of protests against the.
Oh, yes.
Against the board action. Faculty and students have been protesting. You see the...
pretty much since it was announced, right? Immediately.
Yeah. But, right. To me, it's not clear specifically what the board action has been. I keep hearing different stories about what is happening. In fact, it's like the story is still evolving.
It's getting better and better, right?
Additional funds was used to keep the Sons of the Confederacy veterans from protesting on UNC campuses across the state. So it's not clear to me the details. And I've been trying to go through the video of the board meeting at Elizabeth City University, which is a HBUC.
Right.
That they made this decision. They made the decision to give $2.5 million to the Sons of the Confederacy at an HBUC meeting of the Board of Governors.
Well, that's a little bit in your face, isn't it?
That's a little slap.
It's a little on the nose, isn't it?
Could I interject?
Yes, please.
I would think that what the Black Pioneers are really saying in our document, is that the Civil War is behind us. This is the 21st century, and that our activities should be prospective for the future, mm-hmm. and should be aspirational for those persons who are going to follow.
Right.
And therefore, the actions that the Board of Governors takes should be in that vein, as opposed to trying to look to the past.
I like what one thing you say in the letter here is I like everything you say in the letter, but one thing that I think is right on that point is when the Board of Governors makes decisions that affect the university's contribution to society, those decisions should be aimed at promoting societal good. Mm-hmm. The decision that has been made does not do that. I think that's the understatement of all time, you know, personally. I admire that, by the way, that you all, you know, signed your names, the years that you graduated, where you live. And I think that, it, you know, what your statement to the Board of Governors is just is one that's filled with accountability. And I really admire that and appreciate it, because I think that you all went through a lot to get to UNC, went through a lot while you were at UNC to graduate from UNC. Not everybody who arrives at UNC graduates. I think we know this. And, you know, it's still very forward-looking and positive and saying, you know, you still love the university and you want it to do well and you want it to attract world-class students and have a world-class faculty and have it be a world-class university. This decision obstructs that. And I'm still, I think you all feel the same way. You know, how is it that they imagine that this is in advancement of that objective?
And let me just mention, Jean, you said that you made reference to the fact that we signed our names. So let me just say for the listening audience that it wasn't just the three of us.
Oh, no.
That communication to the Board of Governors was signed by 18 of the Black pioneers, that is, that first
right.
generation of African-American students
right.
at Carolina. And there are many others who, 18, by the way, from around the country,
right.
and there are many others who were interested in signing, but we just didn't have the time to get to
right.
as many of those
And we'll
people.
Have this available for everybody to see on the WCHLChapelboro.com website.
Wonderful.
If they want to read the entire text of your message, which is not, you know, it's not the Mueller report. It's not 400 pages. It's quite accessible and understandable, and I think that the university should answer. Yes.
For many years, I would come to Chapel Hill after graduating because mm-hmm. I met my wife here in Chapel Hill.
Wonderful.
Okay? And when we would visit her parents, I would not come back on campus until I retired. And moved back to Chapel Hill, and I went to one of the bar events, Black Alumni Reunion events.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, they showed a video that included Charlie Scott and how the university was making progress in diversity. And the line that I remember is that the university was striving and it created a motto of the University of the People.
Mm-hmm.
I said, that's right.
That's
what
right.
this learning institution should be. And since then, I've been participating mm-hmm. in activities on campus and support of the Black Alumni Reunion. And this decision by the board struck me hard.
Yeah.
Struck me hard because it was against that premise that this was trying to be, the university motto was to be the university of the people, and this action did not accomplish that goal.
I think that's an excellent summary. We're gonna stop it there, and then we're gonna take a quick break, and then we're gonna wrap up with our final moments with the Black pioneers of UNC Chapel Hill. And you're listening to the Weekend Water Cooler on 97.9 The Hill. Don't go away. We'll be right back. And we're back with our closing moments with the Black pioneers of UNC Chapel Hill. And you all have written a very important message to the Board of Governors about the controversy over so-called Silent Sam and his removal from campus and his delivery into the hands, potentially, of the Sons of Confederate Veterans, and along with a $2.5 million, I don't know, what is that ransom? I don't even know what we're calling that money. As far as I'm concerned, it's kind of blood money, to be honest with you. The Board of Governors, we've talked about this during our break, as far as we know, has not taken an official action to bind the university and convey this money to this group. And you all have asked them at the end of your message, first of all, that if the right and best thing for them to do is to come out onto the front steps at the microphones and say, okay, we're not doing that. We were talking about doing it. It got leaked into the media, and we've all thought better of it. You know, we wish this were true. We've all thought better of it, and we're not going to do it. We don't think they're really going to do that, but that would be the best outcome. And then they could just say, and instead, we're giving $2.5 million to the Sonia Stone Center at the university because that's the right thing for them to do. But we don't imagine necessarily that they're going to take the action that I would advise. So Walter, talk to me very quickly about what you've asked them to do with regard to money at the end of this message.
Thanks, Jean.
Because I know they listen to the Weekend Water Cooler.
Very good. Thanks, Jean. It is my understanding that the action has been taken. So what we as Black Pioneers asked was that if legally possible,
okay,
that
right.
agreement be undone.
Much more accurate.
And
thank
if
you.
It's not undone, if it can't legally be undone, mm-hmm. then we want to see some counteraction taken on the other side. Specifically, our request was that $2.5 million be allocated for scholarships to the Light mm-hmm. on the Hill Scholarship Fund.
Right.
And as further support for the Sonia Haynes Stone Center on campus.
Right.
Now, when that discussion started within our group as to what we would want done, actually someone said, let's ask them for $10 million. That was the level of outrage.
Right.
And
right.
I think even if it were $10 million, there are some who would still not feel that it was appropriate or an effective counterbalance
right.
to $2.5 million to the Sons of Confederate Veterans.
Right.
So that's what we're asking, that this action be undone if possible. And if it can't be undone, then $2.5 million for other noble purposes.
And arguably, you know, you're only asking for an equal and opposite reaction, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely.
And that's what it, and even though the money would not be the same, that's what it would take to make it equal and opposite reaction.
Well, I'm not sure it would still be equal, but it would be
right.
an opposite.
Right. 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 I mean, because it's going to take a larger amount of money to undo the blemish that this provides to the university and the negative effect that you were talking about, Lewis, that it's just, you know, it's just not it's not positive. It's not forward thinking. It doesn't help the people of North Carolina
it's
and the state as a growth. It's not aspirational.
Right.
It's the opposite of all those things.
Right.
And so if they're going to do that in order to make up for the ground that they're losing in doing that and taking the state backward, all of these things, it's like that silly bathroom bill nonsense in Charlotte. It's all of these things just injure the reputation of the state. Which, I'm old enough, as the saying goes, to remember when North Carolina was, you know, really developing into this reputation for higher education and this great development and forward-thinking things that were happening under Governor Jim Hunt, in particular about the education reputation for the state. And all of these things injure us, and they injure all of us in attracting great employers and industry that's clean and doesn't destroy our environment, in empowering the people of the state, giving our employers a well-educated and prepared workforce, attracting researchers from all over the world. We need these things. We depend on these things in this community specifically because the university, you know, is trying to be that kind of resource in the Southeast and in the country for that matter. It's a big deal university that's making itself small by doing this, and I'm still flummoxed about how they've convinced themselves that this is in the interest of the university system overall And in Chapel Hill specifically, it makes no sense to me.
Because, you know, your reputation is very, very, very important.
Right.
And if you take actions that blemish your reputation, it takes many, many years to
right.
restore it.
If you, even if you hit undo and say, okay, we did that or we were about to do that, but no, delete, delete, delete. And, you know, a university of this caliber is not a word processor, you know? And a word of stupid decisions like this, I'm just going to say it. Okay, it's my show. I get to say it. That was a dumb call, Board of Governors.
We agree.
Stupid decisions like that, they just ripple through the culture, and people are going to remember that, and there's going to be 10 brilliant research breakthroughs that happen at Carolina, and nobody's going to remember them because they remember this one stupid thing.
Absolutely.
And I can't stand that.
And let me mention that it has been announced that at least $1.5 million grant that was to come to the university mm-hmm. is not going to be made because of it. And a number of people have said they're going to hold up on their contributions to the university because of this. Did you call it stupid?
I think I said stupid,
term.
Yes. Yeah. It certainly is ill-considered, and I have no knowledge at all of what their thinking was. Well, of course, you know, we've run out of time. So I'm going to tell you all, thank you, Lewis Burton and Otto White Jr. and my dear friend Walter Jackson, all three of you. I'm so sorry, Otto, that we didn't get to work in that reference about the game that you were.
J.T. Barber beat Hillside.
And do you remember what year that was?
No, I don't recall, but I think it was probably 1960, 59 or 60.
Yeah, see, he almost came up with it. Yeah, okay. So I thank you all for joining me and telling us all of this history. I hope you'll keep in touch about, you know, when the Board of Governors calls you when you get home tonight. And I want you to call me immediately and tell me what happened and how you gave them what for on the phone. And we're going to keep in touch. And I hope that your effort is successful. I think that to an extent it already has been, to be honest with you. So thank you very much. Congratulations for your work and happy holidays to all of you.
Thank you, Gene. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Darth Vader. I love that voice. I'm just in love with the guy's voice. I'm not going to hide it. So thanks, everyone, and we'll see you next weekend on the Water Cooler.
Follow Gene on Twitter at Gene Bolduc and tweet your comments and questions with the hashtag WCHL.